This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll talk with Roy Fletcher, the well-known political consultant. We'll get Roy's take on what's happening in the political world and also the sporting world. In particular, today we'll look back at the life and times of Paul Dietzel, the legendary LSU football coach, the last man to lead the Tigers to an undefeated season. And we'll talk with Roy and with George Morris, who followed Coach Dietzel at LSU and at South Carolina, where George was a student during Dietzel's last coaching assignment. And David Woolman, his interesting book is called The End of Money. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. We close the week with the esteemed political operative, consultant Roy Fletcher, who's been around for a long time and worked with some of the greats of the business. Good morning, Roy Fletcher.
Good morning, Jim Inkster.
Before we get to politics, we lost Paul Dietzel this week, the man who led LSU to glory in 1958, 55 years ago. 89 significant years from tall Paul Dietzel.
7 years old at the time. I was a big Paul Dietzel man when I was a little boy. Of course, I was a complete Tiger nut at the time. And
you listened to the games on the radio, I bet.
Yeah. And of course, we were in North Louisiana, and it was kind of, it had the fuzz to it. you just kind of hear it. But yeah, he was quite a coach, and it's a shame that he left or whatever. But I'm glad he came back and spent his last days here. I see now he's got a grandson running for Congress.
That's right. Something you know well is people who run for office. I'm surprised you haven't gotten a call from Paul Dietzel, the second.
I don't know. Maybe it's a different era. I don't know.
Well, anyway, Paul Dietzel, the coach, was a man who captivated the masses like few others during his first stay in Baton Rouge. He came back as athletic director, was fired, and then he came back again, and he died in Baton Rouge, the city of his greatest achievement and his greatest disappointment.
Yeah,
that's sad. But he fought in World War II as well, and we don't have many of those around anymore.
Not anymore.
I know Roy was a big NBA fan, too, when he was a kid. He can tell you all the members of the 1968 Philadelphia 76ers and the 1968 Boston Celtics.
I was huge on that, man. Western Conference, I hated the Lakers, but I loved the Celtics.
You loved the Celtics.
Bill Russell was one of those people that's on my Facebook page, is one of my heroes. He's what he endured in Boston and to be such an extraordinary figure in that city's history and that team's history, he's a man.
He'll be 80 years old next February.
Bill Russell will be. Oh, my God.
William Feldon Russell, who was born in Monroe.
Yes, he was.
Moved away from Monroe, Louisiana, to escape the racism of the 1940s in Louisiana. And you mentioned even though he won 11 championships in 13 years in Boston, he found a lot of it there, too, didn't he?
Yeah, Boston was not a hospitable place to him. On the other hand, I think he eventually became the face of that city, which is it's just an incredible story. Bill Russell's story is incredible.
I still think Chamberlain was a greater player.
Huh?
I think Chamberlain was greater.
I don't even want to discuss it. I really don't even want to. I'm not going into that great argument. It's a great argument, but all I know is the Russell won 11 championships. He can't put them on all of his fingers. So, all I know.
You're right. Well, and for those of us who are old enough to remember Russell and Chamberlain and Allie and Frazier, when we see these political guys like Cruz and McConnell go toe to toe, it's just not quite the same.
It's not quite the same. My goodness, Ali Frazier, 14 rounds of the Thriller in Manila. I mean, just a war in the middle of a ring. And, and Russell and Jackie Robinson, I mean, those guys were, you're talking about real, real hero. I mean, another guy. I mean, I remember because my dad, my stepfather knew him well, was Artie Murphy, who was was a hero of mine as well. Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Just unbelievable people.
Well, we'll stay on sports for just a minute or two longer. Frazier and Ali went 41 great rounds, probably shortened each other's lives in the process. But Ali also fought 39 memorable rounds against Kenny Norton.
Kenny Norton,
who
yes.
died a few days ago.
Yes, and it was an unorthodox fighter.
He gave Ali so much trouble.
Right. He was just he fought like a clam or a lobster. I mean, his arms just went.
Had an 80-inch reach.
Yeah, he was a physical specimen. What's amazing is that Ali was ever able to beat him, and he beat Ali the first fight. He broke his jaw
in the second round. And
yeah,
Ali
and
passed.
Ali carried on.
He always carried on. He never got knocked out cold.
I would say that Ali. And Tiger Woods and Michael Jordan are probably the three most international known athletes ever. And Ali was in a time mm-hmm. when there wasn't internets and cable TV and all that.
You're right. But, I would certainly put in the top 10, maybe the top 5, a guy from LSU named Shaquille O'Neal.
I agree with that.
Who's now 41 years old and flirting with politics, I'm told.
I tell you what, he does a great job on commercials.
He does.
The Buick commercial is just, that is Shaq. I mean, that's just him. I mean, it's just, he's cool. He's a really good guy.
And we've got the tallest state capitol. Some would say if we got Shaq, we would have the tallest governor. And he could break all the barriers. I think he could, he is one guy, his personality is so magnetic, he might be able to win.
He will be held to the same rules in politics as everybody else once he steps in. But if he maintains a message and he can, and I know he can articulate it, he would be an extraordinary candidate. But again, he will be held to the same rules as everybody else. So that means that it'll get down and dirty before it's over.
You're right about that. We're visiting with Roy Fletcher, the incomparable political consultant who, in 1995, put Mike Foster in a welder's mask, and Mike Foster ran away with the election against Cleo Fields and Buddy Romer and Mary Landrieu, by the way, who was in that race.
Yeah,
Bill
Price,
Melinda Schwagman.
There's a bunch of people.
It was a bunch of strong candidates against Mike Foster who won. You put Foster in a welder's mask, what would you do with Shaq?
Oh, I don't know. I think that I would give probably just the opposite of what everybody would think, you know. I mean, I'm sure they'd want to build him around basketball, but I don't think I would build him around basketball.
No.
I think there's other things that you can do with it. I think he's got a fascinating story that he's mm-hmm. achieved a lot. And the man is not just a basketball player anymore. He's a personality and he's a businessman. He's developed a brand. Which is pretty interesting.
He's 7'1", about 400 pounds, and he's not overweight.
And he's not overweight?
Not yet.
Not yet, anyway.
And
he can only eat a little bit.
But you can only imagine what it would be like to be on the stage with this guy in a debate.
Yeah,
imagine Governor Jindal or Buddy Romer or Edwin Edwards standing beside Shaquille O'Neal.
Yeah, they might notice somebody's height. I don't know which one. But anyway, or maybe somebody's lack of muscle.
And Americans do, I don't know about Louisianians, but Americans generally vote for the taller guy. That's still a truism.
Well, it is a truism, but, you know, just don't wear a beard.
That's right, or a mustache.
Yeah, or a mustache, yeah. I mean, another guy obviously on the same level as Shaq in Louisiana would be Drew Brees. You know, that would be an interesting candidate.
And he too is flirting with political.
It'd be Shaq versus Drew. That'd be interesting.
Well, let's get to Bobby Jindal, a man you've worked off and on for, who is only 41, same age as Shaq, 42 now, the governor is. He's almost a year older than Shaquille O'Neal. What's the next move for him? You know, he's advertising mightily around the state as we speak, attacking the president on vouchers. It's doubtful that the president's going to be watching television in Shreveport or Lake Charles.
Well, it's a smart move.
Why?
I mean, it drives his positives up, and it gives him he gets to draw a line on something that's important nationally to Republicans, and he gets to talk about the Justice Department, Eric Holder. So, I mean, it's a smart move for it, politically in Louisiana, and I think probably nationally it's not a bad play within the context of the Republican Party.
But could he be setting the stage for a possible run against Senator Landrieu?
Against whom?
Senator Landrieu.
It's possible, but, you know, I would have to say improbable, but possible. I don't think that his numbers are at a place where that he might want to do that yet. On the other hand, I think against Mary, that a Republican that can breathe and can handle the King's English can get 47% on any day of the week. The question is, can they get 50?
And no, nobody has yet.
Nobody has yet.
Except for Mike Foster.
Well,
who beat her
but,
for governor,
but that was a different race and a different time. The next year she beat, but this just shows you how
far. She beat Woody Jenkins.
Yeah, but today I don't know that she would, but the point of it is that it just shows you how quickly the things changed into Woody being able to come within 5,000 votes, even with video poker on the ballot.
5,788 votes on the day that Bill Clinton beat Bob Dole.
Well, I'm sorry I didn't have the exact number, but I was close.
But Bill Clinton that day beat Bob Dole, I think, by 215,000 or so votes.
Oh, it whacked him good.
Which means that about 200,000 people probably voted for Bill Clinton and then voted for Woody Jenkins in Louisiana.
Yeah. Yeah,
which is somewhat hard to explain,
but it is Louisiana.
It happened.
Yes, but you know, I mean, and Mary has through the years has Senator Landrieu has increased her percentage of victory from 50.1 to 53. but she, you know, to her credit, she has.
Well, I looked the other day. Funny you mentioned that when she ran against Woody Jenkins. We have 64 parishes. How many parishes do you think she won in 1996?
8 to 10 max.
She actually won 25 parishes.
Did she really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's because of down the river, too.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
But
right.
Against John Kennedy in 2008, she won 39 parishes. Mm-hmm. So she has incrementally increased her support, and she is an amazing phenomenon because the state.
I think also is that the black contribution to the electorate increased over those years too, about 4 or 5%, and some parishes significantly. So I think that helps her too.
I'm sure it does.
But she has done a great job at increasing her. You know, and to her credit, I mean. She's going to take a beating on Obamacare, but she's not backing up. I mean, that's to her credit. I mean, if you're going to be for Obamacare, if you're going to be a liberal, go be one. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a. I mean, you know, it is. It's a great American tradition. But hang tough and go do it.
So as we sit here on September 27th, 2013, the 64th birthday of the great slugger Mike Schmidt, who led the National League in home runs 8 times.
Oh, was he a great hitter?
Best player of his generation. Between Mays and Bonds, there was nobody better than Michael Jack Schmidt.
No, that's exactly.
As we sit here on this day, what will happen in 2014 in Louisiana?
Mike Schmidt won't hit another home run in between, but we do know that. But he hit plenty. Right now, I would have to give the edge to Landrieu in the Senate race. That don't necessarily mean. The question it really gets down to is how bad is this Obamacare thing fumbled and what's going to happen to people's premiums and do they see that they're getting any benefit out of it? I think that and what's going to happen with a government shutdown potentially and what's going to happen with defunding of it, all of that is up in the play right now. But if you had to guess right now, you would have to give the edge to Landrieu. Let me say this too: is that I don't think that Cassidy can beat her. I think there's a certain amount of you got to have somebody that can get that last 3.5%, 3.1%. I don't think he can.
Well, we'll be following it with Roy Fletcher. Thanks for sharing your insights, keen as they are, Roy Fletcher.
Peace.
We'll be back after this timeout on 89.3 WRKN. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. George Morris, feature writer for the Baton Rouge Advocate and longtime sports writer, who went to the University of South Carolina, where he received his degree at the great school at Columbia. And during that time, the coach of the South Carolina Gamecocks was a man named Paul Franklin Dietzel. Today in Baton Rouge at 11 o'clock, a few hours away, Paul Dietzel's services will be held at First United Methodist Church. People are filing in the church right now to pay tribute to the man who led LSU to its last unbeaten season in 1958. Paul Dietzel directed the Tigers to the national championship. 89 years and many great years in that life of his. And George, let's start first with a story you did a few years ago that people probably don't know about Coach Dietzel, or if they do, it's only cursory knowledge. He was a war hero in World War II. He fought gallantly and was a man who served his country with great distinction.
Well, he did. He was a B-29 pilot and flew 12 bombing missions over Japan, or Japan and Korea, but over, you know, there were, he was based in Tinian, and he was based, of course, this was the same place from which the atomic bombs would later be launched. And his runway, there were four parallel runways on the island of Tinian that had been built, and his was next to the one from which the atomic bombs were launched. And he said that while they were there, they put up fences around that runway and didn't let anyone, you know, come in and in and out as they would with all the other runways. And it was afterwards that he realized, of course, how close he had been to, you know, where the atomic bomb was.
Well, and Dietzel was born in 1924, so we're talking about a young man. He was.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was 20 years old. But you know, it's funny when you see the war movies and the TV depictions. You know, a lot of times they'll have 30, 40 year old actors playing, you know, playing these parts, and you know, they were kids. I mean, if you were in your mid 20s, you were the old man. It's really kind of hard for us to relate to that.
And he was fortunate to come back alive, and as were many others who fought in World War II. And the guy who was synonymous with him in his latter years, and in fact actually helped hire him, was John Ferguson, and worked for him, the voice of the Tigers. He, too, was a heroic pilot during World War II.
Right, actually, and he flew the hump. He flew over the Himalayas from India to China doing support missions, and he had some very harrowing stories of those. But you know, in terms of, yeah, Paul Dietzel, he very much had some close calls. He had, there was one I remember him telling me about, that they had finished a bombing run, and they were flying over the Japanese island of Kyushu. And the bombing had been at night, so I mean, you couldn't really see anything. A lot of the cities, of course, were blacked out. And he suddenly just kind of dawned on him. He says he might want to ask the navigator, how high are the mountains here? And it turns out the mountains were a couple thousand feet higher than they were flying. So they happened to be going down a valley. So, of course, obviously he immediately pulled up and realized how lucky they had been not just to simply crash into an unseen mountain, never to be heard from again.
Well, when you did your feature on Coach Dietzel a few years ago, you reflected on his World War II heroics, and I think he commented that not many people had asked him questions about those years, at least not in recent times.
Well, no, actually not at all. I mean, I think because of his athletic career, and that was high level in every stretch. He was All-American as a player. Obviously, he had won a national championship as a coach. Nobody had asked him. When I went over there and talked to him, he sat down. His wife, Ann, was there with him, and he noted that at this point, of course, obviously LSU that same month was played for the national championship against Alabama, and he was noting that because of LSU's success, he was getting a lot of people, you know, these last few years calling him up asking him about 1958, and said he'd gotten to the point where he really just decided that everything that could be said about the 58 championships had been said. He just said, "I just quit doing interviews." But he said, "George, you're the first person first reporter who's ever asked me to talk about World War II. So that I was very glad that I did, was that I was able to get some of his stories, you know, into print and sort of into the public record.
At LSU, he led the Tigers during the first golden age, and in the late 1950s and early 60s, LSU and Ole Miss, that was the marquee rivalry in college football, with the great Johnny Vaught leading the Ole Miss Rebels, and in those years, they played every year at Tiger Stadium. In one year, before the LSU-Ole Miss game, somebody dropped leaflets on the LSU campus stating, "Go to hell, LSU," and a lot of other disparaging things about the old war school, and Ole Miss was blamed for it. But when Coach Vaught was asked about his knowledge of this, he said, "I didn't know." He said, I thought Dietzel's flying days were over."
I had not heard that story, but let me put it this way. I have no idea whether it's true or not, but it was clever if he did it.
And those were great years for LSU football. And you, when you came to the Advocate in 1982, it was right after Dietzel had resigned under fire. Actually, was fired without any celebration at all when he was athletic director. But many of the writers who were there then, like Dan Hardesty, Bud Montet was still around,
yep.
Sam King, they remembered 1958 and 1961. And this was before the television era. And I think in its own way, the LSU success during the Dietzel years probably captivated this city more so than any time before or since.
Well, everything I've ever heard in terms of talking to people who lived through that period of time and remember it, you know, absolutely that's correct. I mean, LSU had been obviously very good, you know, in the 30s, and you know, and as time, you know, went by, they certainly had some very good teams under Bernie Moore. But, you know, things had faded, and, you know, they had expanded Tiger Stadium. It was at the time one of probably the four or five largest stadiums, college stadiums in the country, and were not close to filling it. There was just simply no buzz about the team. And, of course, and that 58 season just turned everything into, you know, to magic. And from then on, Tiger Stadium on a Saturday night became just one of the happening places in American sport.
Dietzel's salary, which has been noted several times during the last few days when he was hired in 1955, was $13,000. And my friend Les Duay, he's the one who did the math first. He says, think about it, Les Miles makes more in one day. And we're not talking about work days. We're talking 365 days a year. Makes more in one day than Paul Dietzel made in a whole year in 1955.
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, obviously that cannot be explained simply by normal in inflation. But quite frankly, I mean, Charlie McClendon, when he finished, I don't think he ever made $100,000 in a year. And I mean, that was 1979.
And when Dietzel was fired as athletic director, he was earning $66,000 a year, and this was 1982. Joe Oliva now is in the million-dollar range.
Right. I mean, and it just shows how much money, and partly because of television, that has that comes to college athletics. It's really mind-blowing. And matter of fact, if you pull out a media guide from any of those eras, mm-hmm. and you look at the athletic staff section, well, it's all on, you know, half of one page. I mean, including the secretaries, there are probably, other than the coaches, there were probably less than a dozen people. You had a business manager, you had an athletic mm-hmm. director, you had, you know, a few other folks, and that was it. And of course, now you have a tremendously sized athletic department. So it has certainly exploded.
And it all started in a big way around 1957, right around the end of that season. Jimmy Taylor was Dietzel's first All-American. And then 1958 was the magical year, and Dietzel was all of 34 years old. He was a national champ. In 37, he leads a team to a 10-1 season, the only blemish being the opening game against Rice. He's arguably the most heralded coach in the country. He's 37 years old. He's built the program. He is godlike in stature in Baton Rouge and in Louisiana. He could have been here 30, 40 more years. He could have been the Joe Paterno of LSU, but he chose to leave to go to West Point, just as the Vietnam War is breaking out. And he has acknowledged that wasn't a good career move, but why did he do it, George Morris?
Well, it's not a question I've ever asked him about, and obviously I was not in any position. I think largely, and I think this says something about him. I think, of course, obviously he had been an assistant under Red Blake at West Point, Earl Blake, and I think he just loved West Point. He loved what it stood for. Of course, obviously, he was in the Army Air Corps. I mean, so he was an Army man himself, and I think it was just something that he felt that he owed it to try to make Army football. And it's hard for people in today's era to realize how big Army football had been. As a matter of fact, in 1958, when LSU won its first national championship, Army only lost one game.
And had the Heisman winner that year.
Right. I mean, Army, it was on the wane, but still Army football, you know, was as glorious a tradition as Notre Dame, as Southern California, as any of the legendary football powers have been. And so I think perhaps there was a combination of sort of a love of the place. And if you've ever been to if you've ever been to West Point, it is an impressive place. And I think that he, you know, when Coach Blake recommended him as his replacement, I just kind of felt he really kind of couldn't turn it down. But it was a mistake. There's no question about it.
Well, in his first year at Army, 1962, as LSU was going 9-1-1 and had the Heisman Trophy runner-up in Jerry Stovall, who was Dietzel's last LSU All-American, Sports Illustrated had a feature about Paul Dietzel written by Rex Lardner. And it starts this way. Paul Dietzel, young, blonde, tall, lithe, and supercharged, leaped onto the stage of Thayer Hall at West Point a couple of weeks ago, a microphone looped around his neck, and announced he had a surprise. Head coach at Army since last January and called by some the Mike Todd of college football, Dietzel MCs weekly meetings of the Points Quarterback Club, attended by cadets, officers, and friends of Army. Dale Hall, Dietzel's unhappy predecessor, started the club, but seldom handled the program. Dietzel, a witty speaker, a chart man, an organizer, an inveterate coiner and borrower of aphorisms, and these days the busiest man at the Point, delights in leading it. He was a man who captured a room, George. You met him, of course, I guess when you were a student at South Carolina.
I did.
But LSU's had successful coaches and some unsuccessful. But when Bill Arnsparger walked in a room, nobody really took notice. He was a grandfatherly type. When Dietzel walked in a room, people noticed.
Well, there's no question. I mean, he was tall. He was handsome. He was bright-eyed. He was expressive. He had a great smile. He was very much a people person. He knew how to work a room. He knew how to make people feel like he considered them important, that he cared about him. He had that X factor. He had that charisma that that not a lot of us are born with or even can teach ourselves to achieve. I mean, some people have it, and he did.
Well, 1966, after four up-and-down years at Army, he did have a winning record there. And he left the program good enough that they improved after he left. He had a lot of talent that was stocked. He decides to go to Columbia, South Carolina, and his first game was against Charlie McClendon at Tiger Stadium, South Carolina versus LSU.
Right. Of course, now, I have to say this was a little before all this was on my personal radar screen. I was born in 1955, so I think that
you were 11.
I was 11, and had not yet become that enamored with college football. But certainly I've heard the stories of just how, of course, everyone in Baton Rouge had just been so completely just jilted that that Paul Dietzel had left, and of course having in the tradition of so many coaches, mistakenly, you know, said something to the effect of "I'll never leave here." I can remember, of course, Ole Miss fans are still upset that Tommy Tuberville said he would leave Ole Miss in a pine box.
He might.
Yeah, coaches are famous for saying such things when they're put under pressure. But yeah, I mean, it was a kind of an otherworldly way to begin your tenure at South Carolina.
Well, the loss, I think, was 28-12 as South Carolina opened the Dietzel era at Tiger Stadium and lost to Charlie McClendon, who had coached under Dietzel, had been the defensive coordinator on the 58 championship team. And Dietzel that first year went 1-9. He took over a program that was in disarray. But he was also the athletic director at South Carolina, and people may not know the impact that he had on the University of South Carolina, your alma mater.
Oh, it's tremendous impact. And again, and I'm not even sure how, of course, many people in Baton Rouge, you know, have ever thought about this, but when he got there, Carolina Stadium, as it was called, was just a small, decrepit, Depression-era-built stadium that was out at the state fairgrounds. The school had no tradition. It had nothing to impress in the way of facilities. Had never really, I think, had won, 7-3 was the best, you know, that it had ever been in any year. Never won a conference championship. And he raised money and transformed it into a modern stadium. Of course, got a lot of money from the Williams and Bryce families, which is why it's now Williams-Bryce Stadium. Not only that, he redid the school's fight song, took a tune that was from a popular Broadway show that year, Let a Winner Lead the Way, and used that tune to make the fight song.
He wrote the song.
I'm sorry?
He wrote the song.
He wrote the lyrics. I mean, the music right. Itself. Yeah. Right, the music itself.
Well, it's similar to LSU, which took a Broadway song.
Sure.
Hey, Look Me Over.
Exactly.
Came Hey Fighting Tigers.
He designed the logo, the Gamecock logo that is still in use. So, you know, he really had a tremendous impact. He built the athletic dorms. He hired Bobby Richardson as a baseball coach, which got South Carolina going as a baseball program back in an era when very few places tried to. And he, again, in the 1960s, he insisted that South Carolina and all sports would recruit black athletes, which was not the norm in the Deep South in that time. So
he led South Carolina to its first ACC football title in 1969 and made some decisions as athletic director, moving South Carolina out of the ACC.
Which was a tremendously impactful decision.
And we'll talk about that and much more about the Dietzel legacy. Paul Dietzel, 11 o'clock today at First United Methodist for services for the legendary coach. Back in 90 seconds on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, as mentioned a bit earlier. At 11 o'clock, Paul Dietzel's services will be at First United Methodist Church. The coach died at 89 years old, born September 5th, 1924, in Fremont, Ohio. Paul Dietzel came to LSU and Baton Rouge three times, first in 1955 as head coach, then in 1978 as athletic director. He was fired in 82, moved away, and then came back in 1998, and he died this week at the age of 89. Now, he was athletic director at LSU, at Indiana, at South Carolina, and at Samford. Those tenures were not as heralded as his tenures as head coach, particularly at LSU. And at South Carolina, Paul Dietzel, when he was AD, led the charge for USC to drop out of the ACC. George Morris, I guess you were probably in high school at that time.
Yeah, correct. I was, but it was certainly, and it was something that a lot of fans thought was about basketball because there was such a There was such a very heated rivalry that South Carolina had developed under Frank McGuire with the North Carolinas and the Dukes. But it was actually Paul Dietzel who wanted to do that. And his reasoning was, at the time, the Atlantic Coast Conference required you to have an 800 on your SATs to qualify for an athletic scholarship. SEC did not. The Southwest Conference didn't. And so the year that South Carolina won its championship in 1969, they lost all of their non-conference games, and actually by fairly significant scores. Georgia, Tennessee, Florida State all really whacked South Carolina fairly handily. And so he pretty much told the Board of Trustees that if the ACC will not change this policy, we need to get out. The ACC did not change the policy. South Carolina got out. 2 years later, I'm pretty sure that it was thrown out in some kind of court case. Mm-hmm. It may have been a racial discrimination case. I don't know, whatever. So South Carolina lost its affiliation with the ACC, burned a lot of bridges, and then gained no advantage because very shortly thereafter, the ACC was recruiting under the same rules that South Carolina was.
And in 1973, when Dietzel was in his next to last year as a college coach, still a young man, by the way, all of 49 years old, October 27th, first time he's played LSU since the opening game at South Carolina. The Tigers of Charlie McClendon, sixth ranked, undefeated, go to Columbia, South Carolina, October 27th, and face a good South Carolina team. I remember listening to that game on WWL. I was in Little Rock hearing John Ferguson and Walter Hill. George Morris, I think you were in the stands.
I was in the stands, and matter of fact, my left foot was on the 49-yard line, and my right foot was on the 49-yard line. I had a great seat for that game, and it was a knockdown, drag-out affair. Dietzel threw everything but the kitchen sink. He actually had a play where his tight end, Marty Woolbright, would go out to take the ball in reverse, and in that particular game, he threw four passes from the tight end, one of which was for a touchdown. It just went back and forth. It was incredible. And the heartbreak for the South Carolina fan was Mike Miley, the late Mike Miley, managed to somehow scramble out of a tremendous pass rush by time, and he found Ben Jones wide open on the sidelines by the LSU bench, who took the pass, ran down to about the 5-yard line. LSU punches in what turned out to be the winning score. South Carolina had missed an extra point and then failed on a two-point conversion. So instead of trailing by 2 points, South Carolina was now trailing by 4 points, drove to about the 14-yard line, but, of course, a field goal would do South Carolina no good and failed to score. But it was really one of the most exciting games I have ever seen to this day.
33-29 is the score. South Carolina had an assistant coach named Jerry Stovall.
That is
who
correct.
Who was quoted as saying, "I never wanted to win a game so badly." And little did we know that a few years later, Paul Dietzel comes back to LSU as athletic director. He's hired, some say, to fire Charlie McClendon, which he did. He hires Bo Ryan, 34 years old, two ACC championships in 4 years at North Carolina State, and 42 days later, Bo Ryan dies in a plane crash, and he has to call on Jerry Stovall to become the head coach. And those two are forever intertwined. I talked with Coach Stovall this week, George, and we noted that from age 17 to age 72, which is the age Stovall is right now, Paul Dietzel had a major impact on his life.
Well, I don't think there's any question that that was the case. And as coaches often do, I mean, he touched a lot of lives, but certainly theirs were linked, you know, in many times, in many places, and, you know, and continued because Coach Dietzel, you know, moved back here, I think it was largely, of course, I mean, he has a son and grandson, you know, here, but certainly, in spite of the disappointments that took place with his being removed as athletic director, he apparently loved it here and loved the people here, mm-hmm. and I think people here really grew to really appreciate him which is a good thing, because you know, we all, none of us is successful in everything to the degree that we want to or everyone else wants to.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he was someone that people realized whose achievements so overshadowed his failings that you just couldn't help but like and respect him.
Well, he became an accomplished painter, and I'm sure his paintings now will gain immense value with his death. And it is notable that LSU now has several living former coaches, Curly Hallman, Jerry DiNardo, Mike Archer, Bill Arnsparger, Hal Hunter. The only ones who live in Baton Rouge were Paul Dietzel, who died this week, and Jerry Stovall. And I think it's because they had that emotional tie to LSU that is directly related to those years in the late 50s and early 60s.
Right. And of course, before his passing, Charlie McLennan had moved back here. And so, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of, you know, it was, you know, I think it was really unfortunate what happened to his athletic directorship here. And also at South Carolina, I mean, that was when he resigned as football coach, he anticipated remaining on as athletic director, and he was a great athletic director for South Carolina. Unfortunately for him, when the board began looking for candidates, the one they settled on, Jim Carlin, did not want the former football coach to be his boss, and so they created a position in the administration that, of course, was meaningless, and he just stayed a couple months until he became the Ohio Valley Conference Commissioner.
Well, to show you how things have changed, and we're going to wrap it up with this. When Dietzel was coach, he's the one who constructed the Chinese bandits, and he also brought that concept to Army, by the way. And one of the chants, now imagine this getting in Sports Illustrated as it did in 1962, George. Chinese bandits on their way, listen to what Confucius say. Chinese bandits like to knock, going to stop a touchdown, chop, chop. Wouldn't work today.
No, this politically correct is not a phrase that you can apply to the Chinese bandit song.
Well, thank you, George Morris. Good to see you as always.
My pleasure.
This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest is David Wollman, a contributing editor at Wired. He's written for Outside, Mother Jones, Newsweek, Discover, Forbes, and Salon, and a former Fulbright Journalism Fellow in Japan. He's a graduate of Stanford University's journalism program and lives in Portland, Oregon, where he is joining us. David Wollman's latest work is The End of Money. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Tell us about The End of Money. How are we going to get by without credit cards and checks and all those kinds of things, or can we?
Well, of course, money's not going anywhere. This is, The End of Money refers to money in its most commonly recognized form, right? The way you learned about money as a first grader, those rectangular slips of paper and little metal plugs. And cash is this marvelous technology that has catalyzed prosperity growth throughout the world for millennia. But the question has sort of come up of late whether cash's time has finally come. It's a much more expensive medium of exchange and store of value than we might think at first blush, because it seems so straightforward and simple and innocuous, really, cash. And yet there are these myriad costs that are sort of hiding out there. And at the same time, this rush of new technological developments that make it easier and more efficient and sort of more friction-free for people to transact. So I've been poking around about this question of sort of the fate or dubious fate of cash. And a couple of years ago, I posited sort of a short essay in Wired. It was mostly kind of pugnacious and cheeky to get the conversation going a little bit about whether cash is just too expensive, too carbon-intensive, too germ-saturated. You know, let's put a fork in it already. And the response to this short little piece was enormous and quite hostile, to be honest. And that was, number one, entertaining. Number two, informative, because to me it seemed so out of whack that cash has already been quite marginalized in the economy, right, in our everyday lives. Sure, we use it here and there, but it's sort of been pushed to the edge of this cliff already. And yet, when you say to people, hey, let's wander over to the edge of the cliff and see why is it here in the first place? Should we save it? Should we elbow it over the cliff because of some of these costs that are being recognized, et cetera? You know, people really jump to its defense like you've insulted their mother or something. And that that disproportion or that kind of out-of-whack emotional response really said to me, wow, this is there's so much more here than a quick little essay. I want to dig down into the story of cash and its history and its imaginations and this question of its future.
The book from David Wolman is The End of Money, Counterfeiters, Preachers, Techies, Dreamers, and the Coming Cashless Society. Now, when you went some time without using any cash, what did you use?
Right. Well, a lot of the time it was plain old plastic, which is hardly a marvelous or new technology, I should say. But this was a way for me to kind of, number one, infuse some conversational tone in the book. You know, this, I'm not an academic, and I didn't want to write a really old, sort of boring white paper about medium of exchange. And so one way to do that is to give some personal touch. And so I tried not to even touch cash for an entire year because the thinking was, well, if I'm going to be talking about the possible cashless future, what would that even look like? And what kind of hang-ups or hiccups would I run into in my everyday life while trying to do that? And granted, you know, I'm not in the vending industry, and I don't wait tables or I don't drive a cab. So I sort of have an advantage in terms of trying to pull off this experiment. But there were still some hang-ups I ran into, you know, small stuff like a parking meter in some smaller towns that don't accept a credit card, or trying to pay the babysitter one night. That was amusing when my wife didn't have any cash on her, and the babysitter's dad, understandably so, he said no thank you when I asked him to open a PayPal account on the fly so that I could use PayPal Mobile's digital tool there to just basically flash the money like a text message over to the babysitter. So that was a moment when I figured, you know, this experiment probably isn't worth stealing from the babysitter who just worked hard to take care of my children. So, you know, there were a few moments like that. And then, of course, when I flew to India, that was a week when I really had to take a time out from the experiment, because to do anything outside the airport or the hotel in India, I'm going to need some cash.
Well, some people believe that when we pay with cash, that we are more conscious about what we're paying for and how much we're spending. It's a little easier to swipe a card and not realize or not appreciate that we're spending, you know, $100, $125 for a meal. But if we pay in cash, there's no getting around it. Are we more frugal when we use cash?
Absolutely. This is a big thread in the book, sort of the psychology of money and spending behavior. And the phenomenon at work there that you're talking about, the sort of psychological phenomenon, is something that academics call, quote-unquote, pain in spending. In other words, and you don't, frankly, need to be a PhD to grasp this idea, it's a lot harder to part with a $100 bill than it is to part with equivalent funds in electronic form.
Well, you, speaking of Benjamins, don't think the Federal Reserve is on the right track. A new $100 bill is scheduled to be unveiled very shortly.
Oh, my goodness. It's a poor $100 bill. So this thing was supposed to be released into the ocean of circulation in 2011, but the Bureau of Engraving and Printing ran into a big snafu because of the whiz-bang anti-counterfeiting technology that is woven into the notes was causing some printing problems. They were getting a little blank sliver of white on some of the notes coming off the presses. So huge delay. They had to stop the presses completely, launch this detailed investigation to figure out what's wrong. You know, parentheses, these are your tax dollars at work trying to sort out these puzzles. Then I learned a couple weeks ago they have run into yet another printing problem. And the Bureau has said to me adamantly they will not miss their self-assigned October deadline for releasing the new 100. And yet, you know, more delays, more wasted money, more overtime for federal employees, and you know, they're printing huge quantities of a technologically sophisticated object. So to a certain extent, I guess one should be sympathetic. Of course they're going to run into some hang-ups. On the other hand, what on earth are $100 bills doing anymore out there in society and in circulation? And the answer is most of them are just greasing the wheels of criminal enterprises, right? So most $100 bills, something like 70% of them, already they just live overseas. People are hoarding them or they're hiding them in steal briefcases owned by mafioso in Moscow or drug dealers in Mexico. You know, the 100 doesn't really do what cash is supposed to do. The $20 bill does much more so. But 100s are really the quote-unquote currency of crime.
Well, the book is The End of Money, Counterfeiters, Preachers, Techies, Dreamers, and the Coming Cashless Society from David Wolman. It was named one of Amazon.com's top 100 books of 2012, and it's out in paperback in 2013 as we speak with David, and we congratulate you on a compelling work. Many people are buzzing about The End of Money. Thank you, David.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. I hope everyone has a great weekend, and come Monday, we'll revisit the LSU-Georgia game as the Tigers and Bulldogs tangle in Athens on Saturday in a shootout in the Southeastern Conference. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.